Good afternoon. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you whom I haven't had the pleasure of meeting, I'm Paul LeClaire, the president of the greatest library in the world, the New York Public Library. And on behalf of Katie Marin, our wonderful chairman, and all of our trustees, some of whom are here today, and all of our staff members, I'm delighted to welcome you to the Celeste Bartos Forum for this very, very special lunch of friends of the library, among friends of the library, in order to hear Randy Cohen, who is a wonderful friend of ours, for bringing his remarkable talents as a writer and as a columnist here to the library as a gift to us absolutely for free. So thank you, Randy, in advance. This program is put together, as I think you all know, by a wonderful committee of dedicated volunteers here at the library, led by Lynn Goldberg and Wendy Nicholson. And let's give them a very special thanks again for this year for organizing a superb program. Events such as today's lecture are one way that we have of thanking you for your ongoing relationship to the library and for your generosity to the library as friends of the library. Most people in New York don't realize that the building that you are in now holds a private library under private control that is sponsored and supported almost entirely by the private sector, by women and men such as yourselves, many, many more in number, spread throughout our city and even beyond. And one of the special things about this library is how individual philanthropy has, over the course of 110 years, created one of the single greatest libraries in human history. But we could never have gotten this far without private sector support, and we certainly won't be able to fulfill our dreams for the future of the library without private sector support. So if you are not already a friend, please, please, before you leave the room tonight, today, ever, become a friend of the New York Public Library, and if you are already a friend, upgrade. Upgrade. It'll make you feel wonderful because you will know every night when you go to bed and every time you close your checkbook and when you fill out your income tax forms that you helped bring the massive resources of this incredible library to countless numbers of people who come to us physically and who come to us through the internet. You might not like the internet necessarily, but lots of folks now will have 25 million, 26 million visits this year to the library and its collections through the internet, and increasingly very, very great amounts of important content is being put online for the free use of all the public. And you as a donor to the library are part of one of the most interesting, important, and essential experiments in democratic access in this country, right here by supporting the New York Public Library. We're all about giving it all away. We just raise as much money as we possibly can in turn to give our collections away to everyone completely for free. So if you're not our partner, become our partner. And if you are a partner, try to become a partner at a higher level. And you'll benefit the people of this town and people all around America and the world. I'm now delighted to introduce today's event and the chair of that event, who is Lynn Goldberg. Previously, Lynn was the director of publicity for Farrar, Straus & Giroux, one of the greatest publishers in America, and the publishing house, I believe, that has published more Nobel laureates than any other one in our country. She was director of publicity for Pantheon Books as well, and she was the publicity manager of Random House, the biggest publisher in America. Before her publishing career, she was a teacher of African American Studies in New York City public high schools. Ms. Goldberg has been profiled by Publishers Weekly and PR Week, and she's been interviewed on the Today Show, on NBC Nightly News, and on Public Radio International's Marketplace. The New York Observer, the pink newspaper in New York, designated her, quote, the Brigadier General of Big Book Publicity, and her innovative public relations campaigns have been cited in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, Newsweek, Vanity Fair, and The Economist. What's left? Not much. She serves on the Board of Poets and Writers. She's been a member of the Executive Committee of the Board of the Penn American Center, And she's been a very, very special and committed friend of the New York Public Library for many years. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Lynn Goldberg.
Hello? Okay. Randy Cohen started out funny. His first professional work was writing humor pieces, essays, and stories for The New Yorker, Harper's, The Atlantic, and even Young Love Comics. A collection of these pieces, Diary of a Flying Man, was published by Knopf. Cohen also wrote The News Quiz, a column of topical comedy for Slate, the online magazine. His first television work was writing for Late Night with David Letterman, for which he won 3 Emmys. His 4th Emmy was for a show called TV Nation. He says he received a 5th Emmy as a result of a clerical error. He kept it. Now, he has shifted gears and he writes The Ethicist, a wildly popular column for the New York Times Magazine. He is also the ethics columnist for the Times of London. To top this all off, Randy's a regular contributor to Weekend All Things Considered on National Public Radio. A book based on his Times columns, The Good, The Bad, and The Difference, was published by Broadway Books and is available to buy here today. Randy was born in Charleston, South Carolina, and raised in Reading, Pennsylvania. He attended graduate school at the California Institute for the Arts as a music major studying composition. He says he is unable to account for any of these circumstances. But by happy circumstance, Randy is with us today to talk about how to be good.
Thank you very much. We could divide ethics into 2 kind of broad areas. The first would be, what is the right thing to do? How do we work that out? And the second, once we establish what right conduct is, how do we get everyone to do it? And I think we would have a kind of general consensus about the former. Most of us in this room would agree you shouldn't lie, you shouldn't cheat, you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't kill a lot of guys, unless they need killing. So we could form a rough consensus on what is right conduct, but I think we'd have a harder time agreeing how we get people to behave that way. And that's what I'd like to speak about this afternoon. Not the what. Let's assume we have that consensus, but the how. Benjamin Franklin knew how, or thought he did. In 1728, when he was still a young man, he was only 22. Well, here's how he describes it in his autobiography. It was about this time I conceived the bold and arduous project of arriving at moral perfection. I wished to live without committing any fault at any time. I would conquer all that either natural inclination, custom, or company might lead me into. As I knew, or thought I knew, what was right and wrong, I did not see why I might not always do the one and avoid the other. So he's like us, basically. Now, Franklin was an incredibly practical man. And so the first thing he thought he ought to do to proceed with this was to develop a system. So he wrote down a list of 13 virtues. That's what it is to be good. These 13 things he would have to do. And he wrote a little precept beside each one, a couple of sentences describing it. Number one was temperance. Eat not to dullness, drink not to elevation. Now, note that Franklin is not preaching abstemiousness. He liked a good dinner. He liked a box lunch, I feel. You know, they didn't have the... And he liked a good glass of wine, as the French discovered. Number two, silence. Speak not but what may benefit others or yourself. Avoid trifling conversations. Not so different from what our parents taught us, if you can't say anything nice. Then came order, resolution, frugality, industry, sincerity, justice, and moderation. Number 10 was cleanliness. Tolerate no uncleanliness in body, clothes, or habitation. Now, it's interesting that Franklin saw this as a moral attribute and not as a dry cleaning problem. 11 was tranquility. 12 is chastity. Franklin wrote, rarely use venery, sex, but for health or offspring. Never to dullness, weakness, or the injury of your own or another's peace or reputation. Well, that's not chastity at all. It's Franklin, as we know, very pro-sex, and even quite late in life, as the French discovered. But I think what he has here is a kind of guide to how you have a moral sex life. Don't do anything that will hurt yourself or hurt the other person. Not a bad place to start, Governor Spitzer. Number 13, the last of Franklin's list of virtues, humility, about which he wrote, imitate Jesus and Socrates. Two guys you don't think of as spending all that much time together. So once he'd worked out what it is to be good, the list of 13 virtues, Franklin was then going to take a self-help approach. He was not going to consult experts. This was something he would do as an autonomous person, very much an 18th century idea. I will do this on my own. And in a way, you can see Poor Richard's Almanac as the first self-help book published in America. It's The Seven Habits of Highly Effective Colonials. He's got his list of virtues. He's got his general approach, a self-help approach. Then Franklin felt it would just be a matter of practice and spreadsheets. He was limited by the 18th century technology, but he was a printer, and he had access to the most modern 18th century printing technology. So he made himself a little custom virtue notebook, a little leather-bound notebook, and he ruled a grid on it. And down this column, he wrote the 13 virtues. And across the top, he wrote the days of the week. And he would then practice the virtue of the week plan. he wasn't going to try to be perfect at one go. He would do one thing. And so he might start, he would do frugality. And each time he felt, well, I wasn't sufficiently frugal today, he'd give himself a little check mark. And what he hoped was, as the week wore on, he'd just get more and more frugal. And there'd be no check marks. And so 13 weeks, he'd get through the 13 virtues, he'd be perfect. So he sets out. And in 6 weeks, he reached virtue number 6, industry. Lose no time. Be always employed in something useful. Cut off all unnecessary action. That's when he abandoned the entire project. He wrote, I soon found out that I had undertaken a task of more difficulty than I had imagined. Yes, he had. But it was not for lack of effort or industry. Franklin was an astonishingly hardworking and disciplined person. I think he failed because he took fundamentally the wrong approach. That Franklin felt to achieve moral perfection, to produce good conduct, he had to change his character. And indeed, that's how many philosophers approach the question of virtue, of how to be good, by emphasizing character, by focusing on an individual and working out to larger and larger groups in society, to the family, to the community, to the nation. Aristotle writes about how can we produce the virtuous man, by which he meant a person who would act honorably in any situation, no matter where you put this guy, he would do the right thing. Aristotle understood that we're social creatures and we're affected by our friends, by our neighbors, but he mostly thought you should avoid getting involved with a bad crowd, that it was essentially character that shaped the virtuous man. Well, over the 9 years I've been writing the column, I've more and more come to think that character doesn't come into it at all, that it's something else. And I believe that something else is circumstances, is the communities in which we act, that there may not even be such a thing as character. And that is by far the biggest change in my thinking since I've had my cushy job. There are smaller ways in which having this job has changed me. I've noticed that when I go to a party, the fun stops as soon as I arrive. It's awful. There's always the feeling that something terribly depraved has been going on, and now I get there. I've become a kind of professional wet blanket. And should I be admitted to this formerly debauched gathering, what happens now is, even in a social setting, I'm asked professional questions. People will corner me and ask, "Why, I believe you did earlier." And I think this happens to people in... I like it. No, it was good. It was good. It was a good question. If only it weren't anonymous, I could share it with you. I think this happens to people in many jobs. But sometimes, you know, it's a social setting and all you want to do is socialize. And I was never sure how to handle it. And this is the most useful thing I'm going to offer you the whole afternoon is how you can handle it. If you're an accountant, I'm sure it's tax season, you get this all the time. Well, I asked a friend who is a doctor how to handle this kind of thing. Doctors get this constantly. And she gave me two sentences that work in every situation, and it works no matter what your job is, and I now use these two sentences, and maybe they'll work for you. When someone asks your professional opinion in a social setting, you say, well, take off your clothes and hop up on the table and we'll sort you right out. The other thing that's different now since getting this job is my friends now ask my opinion. My friends now seek my advice. People who've known me for 35 years and wouldn't have given you 2 cents for my opinion will call, and you know that it's a serious thing because they call later than usual, and their voice somehow has dropped an octave. It's, well, can I ask you something? And at first I took this as testimony of my true brilliance, which they were finally recognizing. But alas, they've disabused me of that notion. And now what I think it testifies to is the astonishing power of the New York Times to convey credibility. That the Times, they could pick a poodle on the street and go, "You, Fluffy, you're the ethics dog." People would ask the poodle's advice. I'm the poodle. And I love being the poodle. It's great to be the poodle. I'll tell you a way in which I've not changed. Having this job has not made me even slightly more virtuous. And I don't have to be. It's in my contract. Well, it's not, but it should be. That I feel I'm not meant to be a role model for the kids. I'm not meant to personify virtue. I'm meant to write about these questions in a way the readers find engaging. I don't know if you've met many sports writers, but not one in 50 can hit the jump shot beyond 15 feet, and why should they? They're not hired to be athletes. They're hired to write about athletes. And that's the defense I'm using when the cops drag me away. What it has done, spending the working day thinking about these kind of questions of right and wrong, is it's made me enormously self-conscious about all the ways in which I've fallen short over the years. It is so depressing. It's so demoralizing. I'm fairly certain this qualifies me for some kind of workers' comp. All right, enough about my favorite subject, me, and back to this notion of character, or the lack of character, this kind of relentless focus on the individual. It's interesting that we don't do that in other areas of inquiry. A biologist, say you're a biologist and you're interested in baboon behavior, you wouldn't study one baboon in isolation in a zoo. You would look at tribes of baboons in their natural habitats. Or if you were concerned we're becoming an obese nation, you wouldn't look at one overweight child. You'd look at larger questions about his setting. You'd notice that, well, there's so many cars that it's not safe for him to walk to school, so his folks have to drive him. Or you'd notice that McDonald's spends billions advertising food to this kid, or that we've cut the school budget and there's no gym. You'd look at the way this child lives his or her life. Now we do study the individual. We'd look at a baboon's brain, or we'd look at an individual child's metabolism, but we wouldn't stop there. But ethics, at least as I learned, it is all the individual, all character, all Aristotle, that our circumstances, the way in which we actually live, the communities within which we make our decisions, are hardly mentioned at all. I'll allow that I'm exaggerating the effects of circumstances and minimizing the effects of character, and I'm going to keep on doing it for another 22 minutes. I will acknowledge that we can't separate the two, that you can see it as a kind of nature-nurture thing, that people who we would describe as having good characters tend to create good communities. Good communities tend to create people that we would say have good characters. But for the next few minutes, I want to talk about the communities, the circumstances. And I'd like to argue this, that if we want to change people's behavior, and that's the whole point of ethics. Ethics isn't an abstract exercise. It's about what we do. If we want to change that, we should recognize that there are situations in which people will act very well indeed, and situations in which people will act horribly. Now, this isn't to deprecate the importance of individual choice or to disavow individual responsibility, but it is to say it's really tough to drive at 65 if everybody's passing you at 90. Let me give you some examples. Plagiarism. When I went to high school, nobody cheated. All right, you know, three kids cheated. We knew who they were, and we looked down on them. Not because they had a moral failing, although they did, but because it was an intellectual failing. They cheated because they had to, because they were knuckleheads, and we had contempt for them. We were kids. We weren't nice. I'm sorry. If any of you are in the room, I apologize. Although you all look very honest and quite intellectually capable. My daughter in 2005 graduated from what I think is the best public high school in New York. She graduated from Stuyvesant. She and her classmates were, by any measure, more sophisticated than I was, smarter, harder working, superior to us in every possible way. And every single one of them, without exception, was a cheater. All right, except for her. So she says. So now, if you think, and if there are Stuyvesant parents here, back me up on this, that cheating is a big problem at the school, and everyone in that community is trying to grapple with it, students, parents, administrators. Now, if it's character, if you think that ethics is a function of character, and these kids are cheating because they have bad characters, and the first thing you have to ask is, how did the Board of Ed ingeniously arrange to recruit the 850 most wicked children in New York into one class? The next question is, if it's character that leads to this conduct, it should show up in other places because character has to be consistent. So the debate team should be mired in some kind of cheating scandal. I don't know how you cheat on the debate team, but I bet you could. There should be point shaving on the basketball team. All the stores in the neighborhood should be robbed constantly because these are all the kids with the bad characters who live there. Well, of course, none of this happens. That the kids at Stuyvesant behave no better or worse than the kids at any other New York school. So it seems to me what you have here is not a set of kids with terrible characters. You have created a certain set of circumstances, a certain kind of community where kids cheat. Why is it worse now? What's the difference between their community, their circumstances, and mine? That shifts the burden to me to at least make some explanation for what's different. And I think I can offer you at least one to get us started. Let's take the plagiarized essay problem. When people my age had to write an essay, the first thing you did, you went to this physical thing called the library. And then the first thing you would do is speak to a reference librarian, and she, because in those days always she, would suggest certain books you might begin with to begin your research. So you'd write that down. You go to the card catalog, you write a little more information down, you go get the books, you'd find the material useful for your essay, and you'd write it all out. When you got home, and it was time to start writing up your essay, you already had all that material to cite your sources. That citing your sources was built into your research methods. And by the way, if I can interrupt to say one thing about that library, this was in Reading, Pennsylvania. We had a Carnegie Library. It was unbelievably great. It changed my life. It changed everybody's life to have that there. The first place I went when I was deemed old enough to ride the city bus by myself was to this library. It was wildly better than you could expect, and it transformed our community. That you people have made this possible, I bow to you. This is a great thing for New York, and it's great. It couldn't exist without you, and this is the last kissing up I'm doing in the talk, so enjoy it. So anyway, when my daughter's generation goes, they're assigned an essay. They do all their research online, and it's cut and paste. And it doesn't change the moral dynamic. The moral equation's the same. But what it does is there's nothing built into that method where you have to cite your sources. You're just taking this paragraph and moving it into your paper. So we've changed the circumstances and, as a result, changed the behavior. Let me give you some other examples. at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne, perhaps the most English-named university on earth, in the psychology department, there's a break room. And in the break room, there's you can get a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, a glass of milk, and there's something in the room called the honesty box. And they're English. They use these kind of terms. They're very cute. What you're meant to do when you get your cup of coffee is you look at the little menu and see what it costs, and you're meant to drop some money in the honesty box to pay for your coffee. This system was in place for about 10 years when a member of the department did something very cunning. She changed the sign, the little menu, and she changed it in this way. It still had just a little price list, but she changed a little border that went around the menu at random on alternating days. Some days there would be a floral border. So one day there'd be tulips, one day there'd be daisies, something very simple, the kind of thing you could just do on your computer. On other days, at random, there would be a little border made of eyes, sometimes bespectacled eyes like mine, sometimes glamorous, made-up, sort of fashion model eyes. That's the only thing she changed. And this is a very simple little price list. It's just a sheet of paper like this with the prices on it. On the days the border consisted of eyes, three times as much money ended up in the honesty box. Melissa Bates, who is the psychologist who arranged this experiment, conjectured about why that was so. And here's what she wrote. Models suggest that if you know you're being watched, then for the sake of your reputation, it will pay you to behave more altruistically. All we have done is take advantage of the natural response people have to eyes to manipulate their perception of being watched. That our brains are very, very good at recognizing eyes. And evolutionary biologists suggest that's because when you're a tiny little mammal and you live where there's predators, it's good. If anytime you see two dots, somebody might be watching me, somebody might be ready to eat me. So you put two dots on a piece of paper, people see them as eyes. Evolutionary biologists also conjecture that there's no point in helping other people unless you advertise it, as Bateson says, that I'll give you food when you're hungry, but only, the idea is that I hope when I'm hungry, other people in our community will give me food, but I want them to know what a great, generous guy I am, so they'll do that. If no one sees it, there's no point, says evolutionary biologists. Let me describe three other short experiments. All of these are done not by moral philosophers. Philosophers do very little lab work, which is why it's such a great job. You never have to prove your theories. These three were all done by social psychologists who do have to prove their theories. Each of these looks to measure our willingness to render aid to other people. The first one suggests that our willingness to help one another depends just on what kind of mood we're in. If we're feeling good, sure. If we're feeling bad, you're on your own. This experiment was set up in a shopping mall. And over here, there's a payphone. And an unsuspecting person, just a passerby, is talking on the phone. When that person hangs up the phone, one of the experimenters is going to walk by, and she's got a briefcase. And as soon as she gets in front of the phone booth, she's going to hit a button on her briefcase. All her papers will spill out on the floor. Will this person help her pick up her papers? So here's the variable they set up. Half the time when the person hangs up the phone, a quarter pops into the coin return. Free quarter. The other half of the time, no quarter. When there's a free quarter, 87% of those people rendered aid. They immediately help this woman pick up her papers. Don't get ahead of me. When there's no quarter, when they just hang up the phone, that cut the response rate down to 4%. Now, if you believe in character, character has to be consistent. Your character can't change because you got a quarter. This next experiment looks at something called the group effect. An unsuspecting person is invited to apply for a job, and they're sitting in a room filling out a questionnaire about this job, and a little bit of smoke starts trickling through the air vent. Then a little bit of more smoke, then the room is just filling up with smoke. Will this person tell anyone that the building might be on fire? When the person was alone in the room filling out the questionnaire, 75% of them reported the problem within 4 minutes. Not bad. So here's the variable. Here's what the experimenters do. They bring two other people into the room, people who are in on it, what they call passive shills. They don't mean it in a derogatory way. They're psychologists. They're nice. So the passive shills are sitting there, and they're also filling out a questionnaire, and there's one unsuspecting person. And the same thing happens again. A little bit of smoke, a little more smoke. The passive shills will never move. They're wearing some kind of asbestos suit. The building can burn to the ground. They are not moving. That cut the response rate down to 10%. And the psychologist suggested several reasons that might be so. One is, when you're part of a group, it undermines your sense of danger. You look around and you go, well, here's two total strangers. They aren't scared. Why should I be? It also diffuses responsibility. When you're the only person in the room, you're the only person who can respond to the problem. People tend to. When you're part of a group, you think, well, why doesn't that jerk do it? You know. This third one looks at conflicting obligations affecting our willingness to help other people. This one was set up at the Princeton Theological Seminary on the theory that people who might enroll there are kind of predisposed to help other people. And it's another job questionnaire experiment. People who want to apply to the seminary are asked to fill out a questionnaire describing why they believe they have a religious vocation. When they finish filling this out, they're told to take these papers to a building on the other side of the campus where they'll hear a lecture on programs offered at the seminary. As they're walking across the campus, they encounter a person in distress. Someone's sort of clutching his stomach and moaning, and he actually collapses to the ground. Will they help this guy? Here are the variables. The first group, at random, is told, you're early, we have plenty of time. 63% of those people immediately help the person in distress, which struck me as low, but I don't know. The next group was told, you're on time, but we should really get there. That dropped the response rate to 45%. The third group was urged to hurry. We're late. We have to hear the lecture. They weren't going to perform surgery. They're just going to hear a lecture. That cut the response rate to 10%. If you think there's such a thing as character, then character must be consistent. Remember, Aristotle's virtuous man would do the right thing in any situation. It can't be you become wicked just because someone tells you you're late. If you like these kind of experiments, by the way, these last three come from a book called Lack of Character that is by a moral philosopher, a fellow named John Doris. There's a wonderful book called The Face of Battle, in which a British military historian named John Keegan asks profound questions about people in combat, including this one. Keegan asks, why is it amidst the horror and suffering of combat that most soldiers don't run away? He concludes it's not because of high ideals of patriotism, it's not because of ideology, it's not because of anything we would recognize as character. Keegan believes that most soldiers stand fast so as not to be the least worthy of those assembled. And by those assembled, he doesn't mean the whole army. He means the two people on my left and the two people on my right. He means my neighborhood. That Keegan thinks that most people will not be awful villains, nor will they be extraordinary heroes. Most people will act as well as the people in their neighborhood act. Something very similar has been observed in the careers of police officers. You take a rookie cop and you put him or her in a corrupt precinct house, you tend to get dirty cops. That his or her ethics hardly comes into it at all. But if you take the same young officer, and since we don't have that time machine working yet, I mean someone who's demographically the same age, same educational background, same kind of religious training, same economic background, statistically the same person. You put that young officer in a clean precinct house, you tend to get honest cops. That his or her ethical training doesn't seem to come into it at all. Now, this isn't to deprecate, again, the importance of individual virtue, but it's to stress the idea that there are conditions under which virtue will flourish, and there are conditions in which it will not. Do you know the Stanford prison experiment? It doesn't matter what you say, it's a rhetorical device. I'm going to tell you about it anyway. In 1971, at the Stanford grad school, 23 students are selected, and at random, they're divided among prisoners and guards, half-called prisoners, half-called guards. Within days, The guards were doing appallingly sadistic things to the prisoners. They were stripping them naked. They were depriving them of food and water. They were subjecting them to sexual humiliation. What does it remind you of? It's Abu Ghraib. Dr. Philip Zimbardo, who was the lead scholar on the Stanford experiment, wrote about his project. It's not that we put bad apples in a good barrel. We put good apples in a bad barrel. The barrel corrupts everything that it touches. That the conditions Zimbardo created at Stanford, and in my view, the conditions we created at Abu Ghraib, made that conduct all but inevitable. One of the striking things about Abu Ghraib was how few people reported the wrongdoing. And there's an obligation to do that under military law. For a long time, no one. Eventually, one soldier slipped an anonymous note under his commanding officer's door. There were military physicians present at Abu Ghraib, and none of them reported the wrongdoing. And these are people with two obligations, their obligations as military officers and their obligations as physicians to report it. None of them did. It's not because gathered at Abu Ghraib were the most wicked doctors in the army, although if there were a TV series called that, I would watch. It's that these were ordinary people placed in situations where this conduct was predictable. Now sometimes people are truly saintly, even under appalling conditions, but that kind of conduct is unpredictable and in very short supply. Oscar Schindler saved 1,000 people at unbelievable risk to himself, but the Germans killed 6 million. And there was nothing about Schindler, either before or after the war, that would have led you to say, there's an extraordinarily virtuous man. He will do the right thing. He was a bit of a shabby businessman, both before and after. In Rwanda, Paul Rusesabagina strikes me as a similar example, a person who showed the most unbelievable courage, saved about 1,000 people, but the Hutu killed 800,000 Tutsi, and they did it in 100 days. They did it often to their neighbors and often by hand using machetes. So we have to revere the actions of these extraordinary individuals, but we can't rely on it. And we can't compel people to act that way. We can't teach people to act that way. But we can build ethical communities, and we do. Most prisons are not Abu Ghraib. Most countries are not Rwanda. In fact, for its history, Rwanda was not Rwanda. So what happened? Well, a professor named Craig Haney, who worked on the Stanford experiment, points out again about his work. What's regarded as appropriate treatment can shift over time. They don't realize how badly they're behaving. That even the most grotesque evil, like the Holocaust, happens gradually. Small anti-Semitic laws are passed, then more severe anti-Jewish laws, and eventually horrors beyond imagining take place. But you gradually change the norms of society. When you look at the photographs of American soldiers who were doing dreadful things at Abu Ghraib, it's quite striking how many of those soldiers are smiling. They are not the photographs of people who have a sense of themselves as behaving badly. And indeed, according to the norms of that closed community of the prison, they were not. They were engaging in normative behavior for their communities. Their characters didn't save them. So what's the solution? Haney suggests one, the importance of outside oversight, that people come in from outside these closed communities and point out how much they've shifted, how far they vary from the humane standards of the broader world. And indeed, that's what the International Red Cross is meant to do in military prisons. There are also more benign cases when this kind of outside oversight is enormously effective. It's been observed that elementary school teachers tend to call on boys more than they call on girls. And if you point this out to a fourth grade teacher, he or she will get quite angry at you and say, I'm not a sexist, I'm a fair-minded person, I'm a good teacher who cares about all my students equally. And everything that teacher's saying is true. That's when you show them the videotape. And it's amazingly effective that if you show teachers tapes that show, oh, in fact, you are calling on boys more than you're calling on girls, they're able to alter their behavior almost instantly. That this kind of a visual outside oversight, unambiguous outside oversight, changes everything. And again, it's not their characters. They're the same character before they see the tape as after they've seen the tape. But outside oversight, changing those circumstances changes their conduct. You can see it in corporate life, too. There are many, many fewer sexual harassment suits now than there were 25 years ago. And if you were a manager of a large company, you might tell yourself it's because you have such a splendid character and you're running things now, but I doubt it. What's changed is the corporate culture. There are now formal policies for dealing with sexual harassment in every Fortune 500 company, and they're very specific in both defining what kind of behavior is forbidden and in telling you how to respond, and not just in an abstract way, but you go to room 307 and you talk to Barney, and there are procedures in place, and that is what reduces it. And you see it in the broader community. If you ran a steel mill, you might see it as an individual moral obligation to not to poison the air. But if you install smokestack scrubbers and your rivals don't, you'll go bankrupt. So your solution is a community-wide one, to look for outside oversight from something like, the EPA, that will impose community-wide standards on everyone. Then it is possible for virtue to flourish. Now, to stress circumstances is, to me, a kind of ethical pragmatism, and it's where we began. That our question, remember, was how do you get people to behave well? And I would argue not by attempting to change their characters, but by changing their circumstances. And by circumstances, I mean communities. To build moral communities within which people can live so that they can behave honorably. Now, that doesn't get us off the hook morally. In fact, I would say it puts us on a bigger hook, because it compels us not to just say, I'm a virtuous person, but to see ourselves as members of communities with reciprocal obligations to the other people in that community, to embrace the idea that if ethics will flourish only in a just society, it's our moral duty to work to build a just society. I'd like to leave you with a single sentence to put this into perspective, and then I'll happily take questions. It's from Samuel Johnson, the great 18th century moralist, who wrote, "Be not too hasty to trust or admire the teachers of morality. They discourse like angels, but they live like men." Thank you very much. Thank you. I would happily take questions. I'm told to ask you to walk to the mic, and I would happily take comments. If you just go over to the mic so everyone can hear. I can hear you, but they can't hear you. You won't go to the mic, will you? There are guards here. They'll wrestle you to the ground. They will. This is a very tough library. All right, I'll repeat the question if it's short. Did everyone hear that? No. Do you want to go to the mic? Because I'll ask your question in a funny French accent. The question was, who had the idea for the column, and was it, why did they get you to do it? How? It was much more generous-spirited. It was an in-house idea, the column. It came from the editors of the New York Times Magazine. They went off on a retreat. I gather they went to the woods. I don't know if you've ever pictured a lot of New York Times editors in the woods. I myself don't like to picture it. It makes me queasy. But they came back with some wonderful ideas for the magazine. Remember when they ran that photo feature for a number of years? What were they thinking? Which I thought was great. That came from their woodland jaunt. So forests, good things for editors. They then asked a bunch of people to audition for this job. And when I say a bunch, I hope you'll picture hundreds so that I'll seem, my triumph will be all the more glorious. But I don't really know the answer. They're either very discreet at the paper or very secretive, depending on your feelings about the paper. I think it was closer to six or eight people. I gather most of them were more plausible candidates than I, in that they were people with real philosophy backgrounds. I have none. As you were told, I was a composition major in school. I came to their attention. That always sounds like it involves the police, that phrase, doesn't it? If you're a writer, your relationship to editors is that of a plumber to contractors. You've worked for a lot of them eventually through your career. So I'd written for the magazine before and the book review and other parts of the paper. And some of these editors I'd written for when they worked other places. Mostly what I'd done with... Pardon? Humor. I'll try to be funnier. I'm doing the best I can. Yeah, I do think so. I do think most of what I'd done before was humorous writing of one kind or another. I hope with a kind of analytical turn, that the kind of humor I like as a reader is always a critique of the culture in some way, even if it's only of the crappy TV shows that are on. And perhaps the folks at the magazine thought that ethics is a kind of daunting topic for a general interest magazine, especially a Sunday morning. So humor is good. Humor is good. It's also that I believe academics can't write, and I encourage that. Anytime a university is helping their professors write better, write an angry letter. Yes, please.
Is it ethical to tell a little white lie to protect someone from embarrassment? And if one is caught, how does one get out of it?
Well, I can't help you make good your escape. I just have one word. Canada is what I would use. But sure, a white lie, yes. We might not agree which ones are the white ones, but if you ask the question, is it ever okay to lie? Well, sure. And the sort of the grand example is, it's 1850, and you're working on the Underground Railroad, because we all would have been heroes, because we're so virtuous, and you have a house full of runaway slaves. And there's a knock on the door, and it's the slave catchers, and the question is, any slaves? Not only may you lie, in my view, you must lie. It's a moral obligation to lie. So once you establish that there are times when it's okay to lie, you can start asking yourself, well, when? And you'll find yourself very able to say, well, anytime I need to, which is wrong. There are times when I would, small socialize, if we're talking about. Here's my example, that when telling the truth leaves the person you're speaking to in a position where there's absolutely nothing they can do but feel awful, I would tend to lie. And here's my example. When we're in Stockholm for the Nobel Prize ceremony, you're Gennigan, I'm just there for the ride, and you turn to me and say, how do I look in this? And you ask me that question in the hotel, I can say, well, I think you'd look better in this other thing. If you're standing in the wings, about to step out and get the prize, that's when I say you look wonderful, wonderful. So that's one example. How you get out of it? Grovel again. Grovel on your way to Canada. Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Here we're alternating.
Is it ethical to keep an Emmy you get through a clerical error?
Well, not technically, but is it tactful to raise that kind of question? Here's what happened, and I'll be tap dancing as fast as I can here. When you get an Emmy, which everyone in this room will, believe me, it's for excellence in television. If you own a television, you'll get one eventually. And you show up at the ceremony. They hand you the physical statue, and you get to take it back with you. If for some reason you can't go, they'll mail it to you. Well, one year, the Emmy ceremony was scheduled for the same week that my daughter was scheduled to be born, which shows that either I understand nothing about family planning or nothing about being a professional in the entertainment business, or neither, that no true professional would make this kind of error. And I confess with some shame, I gave serious thought to skipping the birth and going to the Emmy. But I didn't, because, you know, I have enough guilt. So I asked one of my colleagues if they would pick one up for me. And they're just in a pile backstage. After you get off stage, it's at the Pasadena Civic Arena. There's a hockey rink back there, and they're piled up by the hockey rink. It's not glamorous, but it's pretty cool. It's a part of life I never thought I'd see. So one of my colleagues signed for it and brought it back for me. So that was the one. In that sense, I was entitled to it. But I got another one in the mail, and I did keep it. I gave it to my mother, and if you want to go get it from her, you try.
Yeah. I have a question about regifting. What is your... how do you feel about you get a what is considered a beautiful gift for your birthday when in fact you think it's absolutely horrendous and you throw it in the back of your closet and you've got to go to a birthday party and you rewrap it and you take it and you re-gift it to a friend. And she says, "This is fabulous. Where'd you get it?" What do you tell her?
Not to be so vulgar. I would never ask someone where they got it. Would you? That's terrible. What a rude friend. I'd cut her cold. I like regifting with certain guidelines. I'd avoid the word horrendous, by the way. And I'd assume that the friend isn't the person who actually gave it to you originally. All right, because that's probably tactless also. If someone gives me, I confess again with some embarrassment, I'm not an opera fan. So if someone gives me a really terrific recording of Tosca, it will sit around my house and I won't use it. But lots of people, far more cultured and better people than me by any measure, are opera fans. And so rather, I see no good in having that sit in my apartment unused when it can give pleasure to someone else. And so you have to be sure not to give it to the person who gave it to you. And don't give it to anyone who, as rude as your friend, who would ask where you got it. And give it. And it enlarges human happiness. That's one helpful guideline. The other rule I think I would make is the more impersonal the gift, the more I feel free about doing it. The more intimate the gift, the less I would pass it on. So if you've received, someone's given you a copy of their book of poetry and it says, "To my beloved, I will adore you forever," probably not. Yes.
I would like to just know who you think decides and builds the rules and criteria by which you build. Who decides the criteria and rules that make the society and the environment by which you build your character against or compare it against?
Okay, I do. I was hired to. If you take that question slightly broader to be where do people get their moral sense, a series of places. I firmly believe that it is mostly intuited from the behavior of those around them, initially the behavior of their parents. Most people have values more similar to their own families than dissimilar, with exceptions, but that's where your sense of what it is to be a human being and how we ought to treat one another. First, your family. As you get a little older, as and all the parents in the room can back me up, the young people stop paying any attention to their families, whatever, and their sense of right and wrong is formed by their hoodlum friends. So that becomes your community. Your intimate community is your friends, but it's the neighborhood of the school. But not just those things. The particular religious training you had when you were growing up stamps itself irrevocably upon you. I believe that as you know, if you read the column, I take a resolutely secular approach to these questions. I'm not an observant person in my own life. I don't think I've been inside a synagogue except for bar mitzvahs and weddings in 30 years. But I grew up in a Reform household, and I had a religious education. I was bar mitzvahed. I was confirmed. And it would be nuts to suggest that hasn't significantly shaped my moral view, that I may think myself a secular person, but yet my sense of right and wrong is not so different from my relatives who go to shul every week. So those places, certainly. No more? Oh, one right here. Do you want to run to the mic?
What are you reading?
What am I reading? Now. Right now? Well, I'm not reading right now because it would be rude. Last night I started Black Swan Green, the David Mitchell novel. I'm on like page 40. I'll lend it to you when I'm done because so far it's good. What are you reading?
Henry the Fourth Part Two.
Big fun. No, I'm not being even mildly ironic that I say confessing my failures on opera, I'm very good on Shakespeare, that some friends and I, including Allison right here, we have a Shakespeare group. We get together once a month and we read one out loud, which I recommend to everyone. It's enormously fun. And in the cold weather, you do it in a bar. You can, on a Sunday afternoon, many a bar, people are not drinking enough in New York, by the way, because many a bar will give you their back room on a Sunday afternoon. Liquor and Shakespeare, they naturally go together. And you read one out loud with your friends. It's so much fun. Yes? Enormously fun? So, Henry IV, part two, yeah. Yes?
Yeah, I gave a concert ticket to a friend because I was going to be out of town. It wasn't her birthday or Christmas or even Groundhog Day. She knew it was because I was going to be away. The concert was postponed. Should she have offered to give me back the ticket? She never did, and I didn't ask for it, and I don't know whether I would have taken it if she did, but should she have offered to give me back that ticket? I've wondered about this for a long time.
I think you've sorted that out, yes? It's very hard for me to hear up here. Do you find that for other people? I'm not going deaf, right? You gave concert tickets to a friend. The concert was canceled.
It was postponed.
Postponed. And so happy ending. Then she went 2 weeks later and everyone feels good.
Well, I didn't feel...
Should she have given it back?
Should she have offered to give it back? I don't know whether I would have taken it if she did.
No. Why should she give it? You gave her this present.
But it wasn't a present. It was...
Apparently not.
What I mean is... I specifically said to her, I'm
right,
going to be away, can you,
you
use this ticket?
And should she give them back? Here's how, the sort of perfect way it gets handled, I think, is she offers to give it back and you decline. And then you're both unbelievably gracious.
I would have done, but she didn't offer, and that's what I'm saying. Should she have offered?
Yes, but you should have refused.
Which I would have done.
Because it's a gift. You gave her this gift.
Yeah. Okay.
I have to go. Yeah.
How do you find the mail in response to your columns running, and how does that universe of responses influence your views, if at all?
I get about a couple of hundred emails a week. The column almost always functions on email. Every couple of weeks, the Times sends over a big batch of paper mail that I don't respond to so much. Most of the questions come from email, and about half of those letters, the emails, will be new questions. And about half will be pointing out how wrong I got them in the column last week. And the comments, all comments are negative. That's not entirely true. Every now and then I'll get a letter saying I enjoy the column, but how many of you are writing fan mail when you go home, and you should, to me, by the way. What's impressive about that email, the critical email, is how generous-spirited it is. That it's very conversational in tone, and it has a kind of approach that here's some fascinating moral puzzles we're all trying to solve together. And this mail often suggests all kinds of interesting ideas. The column's very short. I only have 600 words, and I usually do two questions. So often the questions asked or the questions I take up are tough. They're complicated, they're nuanced, and I will grotesquely oversimplify them. That's what I do for a living. I oversimplify. And so readers will respond by suggesting aspects of a question I'd neglected, other lines of reasoning I might have considered, or sometimes, there's a word, it's very ugly, what is it? Oh, when I'm wrong. as indeed I am. And so I'm quite often compelled by the readers, and in my opinion, the intelligence and generosity of the readers to rethink some questions. And I made it my habit for a long time. I would do a corrections column. I used to do them once a year, but I found I wasn't making as many mistakes lately, or I was drinking too much to notice when I did. I don't know, but I'm working on one now where I go back and recant my folly and revisit questions, and it's entirely because the readers have persuaded me that there's a better way to think about it. Yes? The question was, do I feel that people as we age get more or less ethical? Well, Are you laughing because I'm getting worse? I've read Lord of the Flies. So up until the age of what, 18 or 19, they're savages, right? They're ferocious. You wouldn't, you know. And very few of, when we see groups of 18, it's as they age and as they turn into men that I worry. That a group of 16-year-old young men on the street, I confess, sometimes makes me nervous. A group of 75-year-old people of any gender never makes me nervous. And for all I know, given the current gun laws, they're all packing heat, you know, but that doesn't worry me. So I think I've become, I'm not saying I ever would have committed a felony that you can prove, but I'm less inclined to felonious behavior. But I don't know if that's an increase of virtue or just a lack of strength. I need more sleep now. I don't know. I'd like to think that as you one of the things that I think we mean by maturity is the ability to empathize with others. And I think the central idea of ethics is about how our conduct affects other people. And if you can empathize with others, that's the beginning of behaving properly. So, and I associate that with maturity. Not mine, but yours.
You can take one more question, or else it's time to sign books.
All right, we have one more, but the pressure's really on, because it's the last question.
You've been reading about all the political scandals that have gone on in this city. You talk about community. Is there anything that you can do? Who oversees this community?
The question is... the question is, there have been a lot of political shenanigans in our community, in our city, and who oversees it? And the answer, of course, is there are many regulators that do, and as Elliot Spitzer discovered, some of them are quite good at it. It's true, I think, in a larger sense, that with certainly the current administration in Washington is less enthusiastic about oversight in every aspect. I'm trying to stay away from politics, but see me later. So that, from my view, yes, that vigorous oversight, not necessarily punishment, but maybe punishment, but regular oversight and transparency so people know what their officials are doing is a great thing, and I'm for it. Thank you very much.